Welcome to Outspoken Voices, a podcast from Family Equality that is by and for LGBTQ plus families. I'm Emily McGranahan, and I'm the Director of Corporate and Foundation Relations with Family Equality. I'm also a queer parent myself and proud child of lesbian moms. I'm here with Dakota. Hey, Dakota.
So glad to be back with you. We went out, by the way, I'm the creative director at Family Equality, and I am also a proud child of lesbian moms. Mm-hmm. And just so excited to share this podcast with the world. We went out to Texas and taped this lovely conversation that I am just so excited to get into.
I got to listen to this full conversation with these amazing parents who gathered with our CEO, Stacy, to talk about really navigating race in the Texas school system. And it was just incredible. I really have to say, everyone listening, I'm just so glad that you're here, because this is an episode that everyone needs to listen to. I think there are many people who will feel recognition in their stories. And there are folks who can be accomplices in the fight for racial equity in schools and really learn and gain a lot from listening to these very real, very powerful advocates and activists. So I'm really excited. Let's listen and learn and honestly, I'm not kidding, get the tissues ready and be inspired together.
Suspect, no evidence. These are words that a teacher used to describe my son when we asked her to fill out an ADHD evaluation form. Rather than answering a yes or no question, which was, has the child ever taken anything from your classroom, she decided to write, suspect, no evidence. When we escalated to the administration and they asked her why she wrote those words, she said, well, he's one of a few kids in a certain section of my room where erasers were missing, and I thought that it may be him. This is not uncommon to folks who have children of color in the school system. And as Family Equality continues to advocate for LGBTQ plus families, we can't forget the conversation around what our kids go through as we're navigating these school systems, especially kids of color. So today I am joined by several parents and our wonderful facilitator, Luna. I am joined by Sherilyn Stevenson, my wife, who recently joined the ISD's leadership committee so she can become a strong advocate for queer parents and especially parents who have kids of color in the school system. Next we have Melanie Main, who is an administrator, a teacher, and also a parent of kids of color. We also have Jackie Juarez, who is a parent of a child of color. And next we have Sonia Parker Good, who is a strong ally of the LGBTQ plus community and also has children in the school system of color. And next we have Luna Malbro, who is our facilitator for today's discussion. And I can't be more excited to get started. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Stacy, for having us. I'm so excited to be here with all of you and to hear a little bit more about your experiences, your families, and like your hopes, right? I think a lot of people do not understand what it's like to be a queer parent, children of color, and all the different things you have to navigate. And so I love that we're here to have these conversations with each other and really talk about whether we're a supporter, you know, or whether we have children that are queer navigating the school system, also being children of color. It's so complex, right? So I just thank you all for being here. And Stacy, thank you for your leadership with Family Equality. It's great to have you. So let's start by just hearing a little bit about your families and you describing, like, what were your hopes for your children? Like, what did you hope their education experience would be like?
So my children are Duke and London, and I guess I should say our children are Duke and London Stevenson. They're her children whenever they act like her, though. My children when they have some act right. So they are our beautiful twin 7-year-old boys that we adopted, and we're so proud of them. But we are also very fearful. And we were fearful from the first moment we knew we were gonna put them in school. We saw firsthand the struggle even when they were 3 years old and a boy told one of my sons, "Ew, you're kissing a boy," when he saw him kissing my wife, thinking because she had a bald head that, you know, that was a boy. You know, they came home and it was, they were already talking to us about people asking them questions about having two moms. So we were very fearful, not hopeful, unfortunately. And what we did when the kids were, even before they went to elementary school, is we pulled them out of preschool and they had a full-time nanny because we wanted to really control that narrative and control the message that was being sent to them and that they were filled with self-love. And we felt that it was a little bit too soon to expect another school to be able to do that. So by the time that they did start kindergarten, we felt we had to. We're very big into education in our family, and we feel that that's the way to success is that education. So we, so the way we dealt with it is really knowing that there wouldn't be representation for our kids in school. We knew that they would have an uphill battle. So Stacy and I had to make a concerted decision to say, we're going to be present, we're going to be loud, we're going to be proud. They're going to know who our name is. They're going to know who our boys are. They're going to know what we stand for, and we're going to advocate for them. So unfortunately, I don't necessarily come from a place of, I was hopeful going in. I feel like I was cautiously optimistic, and we put everything in place to make sure that our kids could have the best experience and the experience that we wanted them to have.
Thank you so much for answering that and really telling us like all the things that you were holding. Jackie, what about you?
Yeah, so that really resonates. My wife, Jennifer, and I married 11 years ago and really didn't know that we wanted to have a family and expand our family. I think part of that was the fear of what is that going to mean, right? How are we going to achieve that? And so when the day finally came that we started that process, we ended at adoption, and that process in and of itself was, you know, very emotional, and there wasn't a lot of representation in our community of other parents that had also other LGBTQ families that have adopted. So we were really kind of navigating that a little blind, which is also kind of our experience with the school system, because there really isn't a lot of representation in the preschool system. Thankfully, we landed on a preschool that was really welcoming and really loving and just took us in. But I think like Cheryl and we said the same thing, we're gonna be loud, we're gonna be proud, you're gonna know who we are. If there's ever any shred of doubt that anything could be going in any direction that's not positive, we're gonna advocate for our son and we're gonna make sure that he feels proud of who he is and the family he comes from. And we've just been following that path, and it's really been showing, we've been seeing the fruits of our labor, of that labor in him, so, yeah.
And Melanie?
I think I came at it from a different avenue because I have white privilege. And although I have lots of friends of color and have for a long time, much longer than I've had children, it's different to hear about it from adult perspectives than to see it happen to your own children. Also because I'm in the school system and I worked in a very diverse school system where people really loved kids and honored their culture, I hoped that that would be the case for my children. But having moved from one school system to another because of where we lived and the drive, I said, okay, well, we'll go ahead and put our kids in school here. My kids are all non-white. We have three children. The 15-year-old is Kaylee, and she's a cheerleader, and that is a real sport, so I will not go on that. She is Salvadorian, Mexican, and white, and could definitely pass as white, so we didn't see it so much with her. My son that's 11 is Mexican, and he's darker, and we've seen some things with him that we were a little shocked by. And then our youngest is 8, and she's half black and half white, and the things we've experienced since adding her to our family have even been very different than what we experienced with them, as far as things that people will even say, like, well, where did you get them, you know, or where did they come from, or, you know, things like that. And it's like, seriously, you know, and also, you know, being in a school that, I mean, it's diverse for the area we live in. It's the most diverse school, but that's still kind of laughable considering. But really, like you guys said, being loud, because I work in that school system, I've really handpicked a lot of teachers. Because I want my children to have teachers that look like them, because my wife and I are both white, and I need my kids to have examples of color, and so I've handpicked teachers, and then I've had to speak up, even in my own school system, when a principal is outwardly racist, and at a kindergarten roundup, she hugged all the white children. And my half African-American daughter, who had never known the label for racism, said, "Why'd she just only hug the white kids, Mommy?" Before I could answer, a black man quickly said, "Because she's a racist, baby." So then I said, "Oh, you know," so we explained, you know, what a racist was, and luckily she got demoted. But it took some time because nobody was listening to the black parents. And so it took me saying, "No, I've witnessed it." And then they're like, "Oh, you witnessed it?" Like, that meant more, which is not the way it should be. And it scares me for my kids, because I know that people are going to discount things they say because they're not white.
And there's so much to unpack with what all y'all are saying. So I have a lot of follow-up questions, but I definitely want to hear from you, Sonia, and hear about your experience.
Sure. I have probably been a mom longer than everyone up here. I have a 33-year-old daughter, and I have two stepdaughters in our blended family now. One 18, Yasmin, who just went to college this fall, and Jasmine, who is 17, and Brittany, of course, who's 33. So in my experience, you know, I would hate to think that not much has changed, but that's unfortunately what I've seen. Raising my daughter, you know, she was born in 88, so pretty much in the 90s, she was a 90s baby. And raising her during that time, I find that I still have the same fears today for my kids that I had when Brittany was coming up in school. Even though we also lived in a predominantly white school district, living in Richardson, and her growing up in Richardson School District, there was always this, this desire to fit in. And I always thought if she could just fit in, if she would, you know, just be a part of, you know, the crowd. And I think about what we go through as parents when we're talking about socializing our kids. And I think, you know, what does it mean to socialize? You know, and I think I heard someone say once that to socialize means that you're becoming suitable for society. And when I hear someone say you're made to be suitable for society, what I think about is we're going through all of this trouble to socialize our kids so that they're suitable for a society. But I wonder about the society and if the society is suitable for our kids. And so now that I have an extended family, and you know, I love, you know, my family now consists of my sister, who is LGBTQ, and she and her wife, you know, I have a nephew now who's 4 years old, and you know, he's in school and going to school, being a biracial, you know, kid with two moms. I worry about him a lot, you know, in school. He's in school in, you know, the largest school district here in Texas, which is DISD. And you know, unfortunately, that's going to bring a lot of, you know, in my opinion, trouble for him. And so I do worry about that. And it's, you know, for the same reasons that I worried about, you know, my girls. Our youngest had a lot of, you know, mental health issues when she was coming through school. And so always being labeled as the troublemaker, not really being looked at as a kid with mental health issues, but being looked at as the kid that was making trouble. And what we know is that, you know, young black girls are three times as likely to be kicked out of school, you know, thrown in, you know, into jail, juvenile justice systems. You know, we know that those statistics are out there. So for me, that was something that my husband and I were always afraid of. It's like, what next? You know, will we get the phone call where the next thing is she's in a juvenile, you know, detention center? So it's just been, you know, a struggle, but you know, being a mom, it's all a struggle, right? And so it's a struggle. It's really hard, but yeah.
I hear that. And, you know, there's something that you said that I feel like hit everybody when you're mm-hmm. like, wonder if society is suitable for our kids. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of, like, the question that I had for all of you around everything that you were weighing when you were deciding to choose what school, you know, to send your children to. And Sherilyn, I know you talked about that a little bit, but if, like, all you can think of, can kind of share about what was that experience like when you were wondering, like, is this a suitable place? Like, mm-hmm. what were some of the concerns that you had that mm-hmm. maybe someone who doesn't have all, you know, all the identities you have and, you know, the families that you have, what would they might need to know about everything that you're holding when you're making that decision of, like, where do I send my kids to school.
And can I just say, you know, very quickly, because there was no decision to be made with my kids. I mean, my kids went to public school and that was it, you know, so we didn't make a decision.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, having to grapple with the fact, like, we live in Garland, and you have to know Garland, you have to live in Garland to know Garland and to know the history of prejudice, racist behavior that has been in that city for all the years that, you know, it's been around. So to send them to Garland School District, it was like, you know, taking a breath every day, you know, and things have happened just over the course of them being in school. I remember one of the teachers, my daughter, she played volleyball, the youngest, she played volleyball, and she had on those long volleyball socks. And she went into practice one morning, and, you know, of course she thought she was cute. She went and picked out her favorite little socks, and she walked in, and her white volleyball coach looked at her and said to her, "You must think you're special." And, you know, Jasmine being Jasmine, she said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I do." Because, again, you talk about, you know, being in certain settings, like I had always taught them, you have a voice. Mm-hmm. You speak up for yourself. As long as you're being respectful, you can speak up and you can say certain things. So you always just, you know, you want so much, you know, for your children. No matter if they're, you know, a child of color or if they are a child with parents of the same sex, you just want so much for your kids. And when you know that there's a big old ugly, cruel world out there that's damning them before they even get a chance to come up and be who they want to be just because of the color of their skin or who their parents are, that's the part of it for me that really just gets to my heart and my soul. So, yeah.
I hear that.
We started off with being intentional about where our kids go to school, even though we are, you know, we could certainly send them to public school here in our local community and we live in a top-rated school district. We still, even though we didn't have time for this, we're commuting, you know, an hour round trip every day to drop the kids off and pick them up at a more diverse school because of, you know, I guess back to the point of not necessarily having that hope. We just expected that it would be a bad experience for them if we didn't choose a school that represented who they were, had teachers that looked like them, and that they would continue, that our kids just wouldn't get lost. So we did that for the year, and then, you know, COVID hit, and that all just went crazy. They're in the local school now, and it's predominantly white. And the unfortunate thing about the position that Stacy and I find ourselves in is we have to almost choose, do you want the neighborhood that you love and the area that you love, or do you want the school that you love? Like, I feel like you're not able to have both. Stacy and I are very suburbia. Like, even before kids, before we ever, like when we were dating, everything, there was never a time we lived downtown. We're not city people. I'm from the country. And Stacy's definitely from the country, like rattlesnake races and all. So we have always lived in the suburbs, and that's where we want to live. But with that, and especially in Texas, with that comes a lot of interesting people. Like, we still have a neighbor that has, you know, Trump won out to this day in his yard. And my parents had to make that decision of, do we put both of our kids in private school in an area that's not necessarily representative of where they wanted to raise us, not necessarily safe, or do we buy a home in another neighborhood that has a public school system that we can get in? So it was kind of choosing that. And I feel like Stacy and I even really ended up doing that as well. And so my parents moved us. They moved us there, and I struggled. I was in an all-white school, and I had no identity. It was taken from me. I was told all the time about, you know, you're pretty for a black girl. You know, you're a cool black girl. I like you because you're different than them. So it was hard for me personally, and that was one of the reasons that pushed me me to wanting to do this hour round trip commute every day, because I wanted my kids to have identity, to have culture, to have representation. And those things aren't found here. So now we, you know, as you guys have seen who have been in our house, I mean, it's pretty blackety black, black, black. You know, you can't walk 2 feet without, like, you know, some black role model.
I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I'm hearing so much about, you know, everything that you've been hoping for and some things that kind of surprised you along the way. So I want to start with you, Melanie, because you kind of hinted to this a little bit earlier. You know, what's your role, first of all, in the school system? And also, like, what were some things that really surprised you, whether that was from your experience in the school system before or just being a parent of children of color? What were some things that you were not prepared to
alluded to this earlier, that when I was a teacher and then I was a campus counselor in a very diverse area. And then I moved to a very white, middle-class area as a high school intervention counselor. And just being there, I think I started to have more fear for my kids because I would hear things in the teacher's lounge. And because I show up white, people will say crazy things. It was about my second, third week at the high school, and I heard two teachers saying, you know, "I'm so glad my third period's over." And somebody said, "Well, why? "Well, that's where I have all those black kids. You know, they never will be quiet." And so I said, "What happened last time they were quiet?" And then I just, you know, I told them what I thought about this. And then I looked at their badge. I said, "Any kid tells me you're racist, I'm a no, because I see you." I really cried working there. For about the first 6 weeks, I kept going home every day and telling my wife, "I'm going to quit." She's like, "You got to have this job. You're not going to quit." And she said, "You know, pray about it. Figure out why God put you there." And I think that that's why I'm there, because I think because I can show up white, that I'm able to make changes that when other people won't listen. And my kids do not go to the same feeder pattern I do in my school district. And every year somebody says, "Well, why aren't you moving your kids to this feeder?" And I said, "Because they have two moms and I need them to see people that look like them too." In a school of 2,500, we had 10 black educators last year. We're now down to 3. On tape, I won't get into what I think that's about. But it's very sad to me. And I've requested teachers based on their color. And, you know, we're not supposed to request teachers. And we had this one principal's real stickler about it, the racist one that ended up losing her job. But I wrote in there, "No, I need my child to have this African-American teacher because I need my child to see people of color in their world, you know." And so she was like, "Well, this is the strangest request I've ever had." And I thought, "Well, yeah, because you're white. That's why, you know." But and I think it surprises me, too, that they downplay things that kids are able to do because of their color. When you start looking at advanced courses or honors courses or college programs, we had never had an HBCU night in my district. In fact, I talked to the counselors, one who had been a counselor for 22 years, and I said, "Why did the HBCUs not come to the college fair?" And she said, "Well, tell me what that is, and I'll find out." Mm-hmm. 22 years.
Wow.
So then she said, "Well, we don't have a lot of black children here, so that's why I didn't know." I said, "If you have one black child here, you should know."
Okay.
So I brought a HBCU fair, and then they said, "Well, can't y'all put it together?" I said, "No, we don't want to be with y'all." Because I said, "Y'all didn't want them with the..." They're like, "You know you're white, right?" And I said, "Yeah, sometimes I forget, but..." I said, you know, but so I was able to have the HBCU night. We had 22 colleges represented. Had alumni come. We also did the fraternity and sorority thing, which is such a bigger deal. When especially, you know, I told the kids, even if you're going to go to a predominantly white institution, then you still need to know what sororities and fraternities are so you can find people that you fit with. And it was amazing. And we have one custodian that's African American. He said, "Miss Maine, where you got all these black people from?" And I said, "Well, because at first I just wanted to do it at my school, but then I said, well, that's not fair to the other schools in the district." So we invited everyone. And I was told eventually by the superintendent that, "Well, from now on, we need to really merge it because we don't want to seem like that we're being discriminatory." I said, "Oh, okay, we're worried now. Okay, I see that." And so, so things like that that really have made a difference.
Thank you. And honestly, you're making a difference because we need, you know.
I have something to say about that.
Oh, yes. I just say, like, you know, We say the word allies, but I like the word accomplice, because when you're an accomplice, you know, you're in it and you're not just being like, "I'm rooting for you." You're like, "I'm taking notes. I'm taking names. I'm reporting. I'm behind the scenes. I see what's happening." But yeah, so
So one of the cool things was Melanie reached out to me about that HBCU night to ask about people that could support and be part of it. And my previous colleague's husband is the police chief of a predominantly black city here in Texas, in Duncanville. And so he was able to...
I forgot, he came and did that guest speaking.
Yeah, so he did a guest speaking opportunity. So it's so beautiful, like the synergy and the sisterhood, and we're so connected with wanting that representation for each other. And so I was so excited when Melanie reached out. I was like, hell yeah, I know someone, you know, and I'm glad that she was able to make that happen.
After that guest speaking event, I said, okay, and I've been talking to some other teachers that are people of color, and then also just white teachers that are woke, because we got to have those, because we barely got any people of color. And, you know, and I said, y'all, I really want to take a picture of just all the black students with him. And they said, we're going to get in trouble. I said, well, better forgiveness, right? So at the end, I said, okay, I need all the black kids to line up at these bleachers. And my principal was like, dear God, what's going on, you know? And so I said, okay, y'all, come on, hurry up, you know? And they're all like, oh, we better get up there. Miss Maine's like yelling on the mic. And so we got a picture with all the black students, and and that's one of my favorite pictures, because I, you know, I have that in my office, and I just, you know, when I want to quit, I remind myself, you know, these kids need me. Same thing for the LGBT kids at our schools. You know, they're discriminated as, you know, as well. But yeah, it's different. It's different when you come at it from a parent. Like, I can be an activist all day or an accomplice at my school, but when you go as a parent, you know, you see how they kind of look at you, and, you know, and they always say, oh, that's so nice that you adopted these children. And I wonder if they'd say that if they were white. You know, I feel like that it's more like, oh, these poor little minority children. And I'm like, no, they bless me. Like, you know, you know, and people have a lot of thoughts about, you know, transracial adoption and things like that. And I don't think everybody should do it, because I know too many people that have done it. And I don't know if they went into it understanding, but you don't get to adopt kids that are not white if you're not going to fight the fight.
I agree. Okay.
And totally, you know, and you've got to have friends of color, because that's not fair to them, you know, so... So, but, you know, so.
Save for the people in the back.
Well, Jackie, I know you had your own experiences that surprised you, too. So if you want to kind of break that down.
So, you know, my wife and I was laughing when you said that you guys are not city girls, because Jennifer and I are city girls. And, I mean, we were the downtown loft, like the living in the neighborhood city girls. So when we adopted our baby, it was integrating him into our life, finding a preschool that was, you know, we would drive the hour-long drive to find a preschool that was the right fit, that was really diverse, that really helped, was welcoming and loving. Then when it came time for, you know, to change preschools, because we decided to leave downtown and move to the burbs, just on the edge of the city.
And you have a swimming pool
and
now.
We have a swimming pool now and a big yard and a really great house, and we love our neighborhood. And so it was all for the right reasons. And we liked the school district. We didn't love it. It's not as great as here, but we just knew we wanted to still be a little closer into the city. I work for Parkland, so, you know, being downtown is important. So when we made that choice, we started looking at preschools in the area, and, you know, it was really interesting because COVID hit, and that really shifted kind of what we were going to make a choice in. We wanted a school that was going to be diverse, but then it was like, now we want a school that's going to be not only diverse, but have our child's health, you know, as the forefront. So when we started looking at the neighborhood that we were in and what the choice we were making, there was no mask mandate, there was nothing. So we said, okay, back to the drawing board. And it just so happened that our dentist, our family dentist, is gay, and he has two children, and he has his children in a Catholic school. And my wife had been tugging on me, I really want him to go to Catholic school, the academic programs, and I really think he'll get a robust academic experience. And my thought was, I was raised Catholic. I remember how the Catholics think about us gays, and I'm not really sure. I was making some generalizations based on my experience. And so I talked to our friend, our dentist, and just said, look, you're gay, you're an out gay man, and you have children. What is your experience like? And it was so positive. He just told us about everything positive. And so I thought, okay, let's talk with them. And we met with the preschool director, and she was loving and welcoming and so kind. I thought, okay, I'm going to need to walk back my fears and really give this a shot. And so we started him at pre-K 4 there.
and it was just so positive. He was really the only Black child in his classroom. A lot of Latino kids, a lot of white kids predominantly, but he was the only Black child. So I thought, okay, I remember that experience. I was the only Hispanic kid in a room full of white kids mm-hmm. growing up. And so what is that going to be like for him? But we just were so welcomed, and that really surprised me at how welcomed and loving people were. And now that he's in a developmental kindergarten program and he's very active, very rambunctious, we've come across a couple of moments where I've questioned the discipline that was being used and maybe if he was being singled out. We've addressed it right away, and it was handled right away. And so, I mean, I think that's the most surprising, mm-hmm. is that it's not what I thought it was going to be. My mm-hmm. fears really were holding me back from making a decision that I think has been the right decision for him. So,
well, I love hearing about a beautiful surprise. That is so great to hear, and especially like hearing that you had the experience of wondering if like, oh, is my baby being singled out? Like, oh, yeah. What is this about? Mm-hmm. And that being squashed, right? Yep. Sherilyn, I know that it was a different experience for you, and like thinking about, you know, you and Stacy and your experience, you know, being lesbian moms, how has that affected your children? Like what surprised you about that? Are there any incidents you can think of that speak to that?
Absolutely. Many, actually. But even if I go back to what my wife said at the front of this, which is when she said suspect, no evidence, I would say that was my biggest surprise, is the form that she's talking about. We were having our kid evaluated for having ADHD. It's very simple. There's, you know, like, does this child speak out of turn? Does this child get up a lot in class? Like, very simple. And it's, you rate them 0 through 4 on each one. So, and that's it. There's no room to write anything else, nothing. So this teacher, instead of even just following the instructions, and this is something that was sent to every one of the kids' teacher. And so instead of her following the instructions and just circling 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, she decides on the one question out of 50 that says if they've ever taken anything, she writes suspect, no evidence. And so when we talk about these surprises and these beautiful surprises, I will tell you one thing. Obviously, Stacy and I were very taken aback mm-hmm. by that. Because I feel that that's the mantra of Black men. Suspect, mm-hmm. no evidence. And in that moment, I cried.
I would too.
And I talked to the principal, and I cried again on the phone with her. And the principal is actually Latina. And she talked to me, and I appreciate it. So the beautiful moment in that was unexpected, is I appreciated her vulnerability with me in that moment of, this is not right. And I am very upset about this, and I am bothered, and this will not happen at my school. And God placed me here for a reason, and I believe it. So it was a moment, and it was a teachable moment. And I don't expect that all of these schools come ready-made. But whenever I do bring something up, whenever my wife does, we're so involved in the kids' education, and that's the key. So even with Triumph, and I think that's the hardest pill to swallow for me, is to know this isn't the end.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that privilege. We are going to deal with this. My kids, unfortunately, are going to have to deal with this. They've already dealt with it. They've already had to be advocates for our family, even at the tender age of 6 and 7 years old. I didn't want them to have to be advocates at this age, but they've had to be. So it's still a beautiful moment to see that we're part of growing this society to make it better for my future grandkids.
I love that. Thank you.
Can I just add that I think, because what you just said, I think really hit home, and this question is so great because it's something that, you know, I thought about, like, why did we choose this school? Why did we choose this neighborhood? Mm-hmm. And
I think our experience has been so interesting because predominantly my child's school is mostly white, mostly heterosexual parents. But I've walked into moments in his aftercare program where a little 3-year-old girl was asking, I mean, she just was so innocently asking him about the skin color of his mommy. She said, "Is your mommy the same color as you?" And I walked in and he's African American, I'm Latino, but people think that I'm mixed or something. Right. And so when they saw me, you know, we started talking about skin color and then started talking about parents. And she said, "Mommy and Daddy." And I said, "No, Kaden has two mommies." Mm-hmm. And it was such an interesting conversation. And so I thought, this is why we're here. Mm-hmm. We're here to enlighten these children that absolutely, they have a really beautiful kid that they love hanging out with. And he comes from a family that doesn't look like theirs. And wow, what a blessing. So.
And you're catching them right at the right time.
Yes.
Because we had that same moment with our kids when they were 3. And they were like, "Do you really have, is it really 2 moms?"
Right.
And I said, "Yeah, isn't that cool?" And the little girl said, "Yeah, I wish I had 5 moms." And so they're so right. innocent. And so it's innocent. A great teachable mm-hmm. moment.
It really
and
is.
It's great to let our kids know. We had our Duke, who was the shy one. He's on the spectrum. And the teacher said something a few weeks ago when she let us know, "Hey, you know, I just wanted to let you know about this moment that Duke had in class today. I mentioned something about your mom and dad at home." And Duke, who is my really super shy, sit in the back class, not want to talk to anyone kid, it's like, "Excuse me, I have 2 mommies." Yeah. And so she sent me that message and I just lost it. Yeah. I was like, "Oh my God, you want a pizza party?"
So we've talked about, you know, some struggles, some resilient, beautiful moments that, you know, you've experienced. But I'm really curious if you can kind of break down and explain to folks, like, what is that day-to-day life experience like, you know, either being a queer parent of a child of color or just being a parent of children of color? Like, what is that day-to-day, like, experience? And I'm sure for each of you, it's different, and in some ways it may be similar, but I'd love to just hear from all of you on that.
Okay, well, I'll start because for me, I think raising 3 beautiful, black, strong, headstrong young women, you know, every day was, like I said, it was a challenge. It really was a challenge to send them out into the world wanting them to have a voice and wanting them to have confidence and to have that resilience and still, like I said before, be able to fit in our society and knowing that, or actually feeling like Black people really don't fit in. So it was like this struggle, always pushing them to fit somewhere that they never really fit. And that was a huge struggle for me. Mm-hmm. And then when our youngest daughter, I guess people still say came out, mm-hmm. you know, and said that she liked girls. You know, my husband is 11 years older than I am. And so he is a Black man born in 59. I'm, you know, like, you know, and even though he's a huge ally and a supporter, just like I am, he loves, you know, every person in my family. This was his daughter, mm-hmm. right? And so still he was like,
"Love
really?
Your gay
mm-hmm.
sister."
Yeah, exactly. My gay sister, my gay aunt, my gay uncles, he loved mm-hmm. gay everybody, like gay chilling and stuff, everybody.
Yeah.
You know, but this was his daughter, you know, and so he never said anything, but you could feel mm-hmm. the angst. You could mm-hmm. feel and I remember talking to him about it, and I remember him saying, you know, it's one thing for her to be gay, right? But it's a whole nother thing for her to be Black and gay. Mm. Like, that was a whole nother set of problems that you're already think about your child being Black in this world, but now being Black and being a lesbian. Mm-hmm. You don't know. It's almost like how much more. Mm-hmm. What else can, you know, she handle? So it was a struggle. It was really, it's been difficult. It's been fearful, mm-hmm. you know, to watch everything that has happened, especially over the pandemic, from George mm-hmm. Floyd mm-hmm. to, you know, the young lady, Ariana, what's her name, mm-hmm. That was shot in her, you know, it's just been, you're so fearful of what can happen to your children. And like I said, with our youngest having mental health issues and self-harming and suicidal ideation and all of that, you just worry so much about, will she overcome these things? Will life get better for her? You know, I'm happy that some days they are. You know, the days are getting better. I'm very happy about that. But some days she still struggles. Mm-hmm. And even that alone causes us, because she's a Black female, you know, this Black female who already, you know, like, we already carry this image of angry Black woman. Mm-hmm. We are the ones that are strong and carrying the charge. And so now she has all of these big opinions and big ideas and big thoughts. And she mm-hmm. doesn't always know how to present them well, because she's very, you know, emotional, but very, you know, just dealing with a lot of her own traumas and her own struggles and things that happened early on in her childhood. And so I just worry about mm-hmm. her all the time. Like, mm-hmm. where's this going? Right. You know? And so just having to, you know, constantly talk. I mean, y'all, we're parents.
Yeah.
Like, this stuff doesn't end. You nope. know, like I said, I have a 33-year-old, and I'm always on the phone talking to her, yeah. you know, because it doesn't end. You think mm-hmm. parenting is, it is for a moment in time, but the feelings, they never go away. Mm-hmm. You never stop worrying. You never stop wondering. You never stop wishing. And I just share that with y'all. It never goes away.
I'm seeing some big head nods.
Yeah. That's exactly, I mean, that's the first thing when you asked that question, the first thing that came to mind was anxiety and worry. Yes. I think it's this constant feeling of, what's he going to walk into today? Is he going to be labeled the loud, bad kid? Is he going to be labeled the, you know, the busy kid? Because he is busy. And I don't want him.
White kids are too.
That's right. That's right. And that's the interesting part is just, when it's him, and always trying to navigate and take my own temperature, am I overreacting? Am I making false accusations, or am I assuming they're coming from a bad place? You know, that part in me. So I think it is a constant worry. Mm-hmm. It's knowing that I'm going to worry about him for the rest of my life, mm-hmm. because he's going to navigate this world without me next to him at some point. And I want to make sure he has the tools, the strength, the words, the restraint, the ability to advocate for himself. And, you know, he's a strong kid, and he's a proud kid. He's a happy boy. But he's also impulsive, and, you know, he is loud, and he's funny and rambunctious. And so wanting to help him learn how to hone all of that, how to bring it in and to use his powers for good. You know, so I think that really resonated with me. Worry.
Good. And I yeah. will say to that, when you said about overreacting, I mean, if you're a parent with a African-American or a child of color, period, overreact.
Yeah.
It's necessary. Yeah. It's necessary.
It's
right.
Right.
Overreact.
Yeah. I think, Sonia, that's what worries me, is because I really try to always, when something happens, of course, our natural instinct is we want to protect our kids and we want to make it better. But I think, you know, having grown up white and still having white privilege, I have to always think, okay, could this be racially motivated? And I have to look at it from that lens, and I have to make sure that I remember that. And or it, could this be because they have two moms, you know? You know, I think that's a scary part for me, because I worry about my kids all the time, and I worry I'm going to miss it. You know, and so I always have to say, okay, let me reflect on this. Could this be, you know, this? And so I do. I rely on my sisters, and I call, you know, my Black sisters, and I say, okay, this is what happened. What am I missing? Am I missing anything? You know, and because I think you're right. Like, we have to look at things so differently, and understand. And it's that same thing. I mean, my 8-year-old Kinsley, she is full of energy, as they say. And but I don't want to break her spirit, because it's right. What makes her who she is. And you know, and so finding those teachers that are spirited too, that seems to be a good match. Or my 8-year-old son, he struggles a lot with the race thing. You know, being Mexican, he's never cared that he has two moms, but he really hates that we're white, which really in turn means he hates that he's not. Mm. And so we've had to work a lot and really make sure that we embrace the culture, and we talk about different holidays, and we talk about cultural events and soul food, and you know, and the struggle, and talk about you know heroes of all colors, yeah, and all, you know, genders, right, and sexual orientations, yeah, and make sure that, you know, that they feel that. But I think that's my fear, is the underreacting, sure, you know, and so many of our friends, and probably more associates, I'm probably not too close to people that feel this way, but they'll say, oh, well, you know, this happens to all kids. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, you know, all kids struggle. Yeah, but all kids don't show up as a person of color. Mm-hmm. And the struggle's different, mm-hmm, you know? Yeah. And so just trying to make sure I always remember that. Mm-hmm. And
what has me emotional is that my kids' innocence is lost. They don't get to just exist. And they don't know why mommy and mama tell them they can't just go run outside by themselves and play with all the neighborhood kids who don't look like them. And so I cry and I get emotional for the innocence that's lost for my kids, because they just want to be kids. But my wife and I have an extraordinary responsibility to make sure that they aren't put into a category of a predator because mm-hmm. they have lesbian moms, mm-hmm. or a predator because they're black men with a white girl. So we have to, every time that they come home and they say, you know, Becky Lou is my girlfriend. No, she's not. What's a girlfriend? No, she's just a friend. There's no difference. And we take that innocence from our children, and I'm emotional, and I yearn, and I cry, and I wish that my kids had the innocence and the privilege of being able to just play with kids, and they can't. And my wife and I have to remind them every day, you know, and if they even get in a little bit of trouble at school, we're on them as if they just punched a kid in the face.
Right.
Because we don't get to make those mistakes. Mm-hmm. Because we're judged so harshly in the black community. Because it doesn't, you like, one kid can go run around the school doing like, ah, but if our kid does it, they're suspended. Mm-hmm. It's that reality of knowing that the thing that I talk to my wife about, like when we have pillow talk, is sometimes I feel regret that we brought them into this situation knowing that it was going to be an impossible situation for them. But we're willing to uplift them and give them all the tools that we can, but we can't promise that they won't have a gun pulled out on them. There's not one black man in my family that has it. We can't promise that they're not going to be called a derogatory statement. We can't promise that they can willingly go have a play date with friends. And so I mourn my kids' childhood, honestly. Mm-hmm. Because I can't give them that childhood, because when you know better, you do better. Mm-hmm. And I know better, and I know what our community has experienced. And I just can't allow my kids to just be free black men, because mm-hmm. they're not.
I feel that, you know, I'm not a parent, so I don't feel that in the same way that you do, but I think this is why family equality does the work that it does. and why these kinds of conversations are so important. And I really appreciate all of you for sharing, because people don't know. And we have to illuminate this. You know, we have to illuminate everything, that all the fear that you all share, that you hold, right? And we have to illuminate that so the hopes that you have can be realized.
And I think that so much, while we have to live our authentic lives, and while we have to move into neighborhoods like this one, mm-hmm. and while we have to, you know, have our children of color involved in different things, so, and being out lesbians, you know, not Sonia, but the rest of us, but you know, I think that that's another reason we have to live authentically, so people mm-hmm. see that it's okay, and that we're just right. the same people, right. and we Texas. Want the same, yeah, out here in Texas. Yay. Out here right. in Texas.
In the suburbs.
In the suburbs of Texas.
Suburbs of Texas.
Growing up in the suburbs of Texas, that what you said really hits home, because being a child of color in a predominantly white neighborhood growing up, no gay family in sight. I never saw that. No. Now raising, you know, our child as an out lesbian family, and already before we moved into the neighborhood, we were informed that somebody told one of our neighbors to be careful, watch out for those lesbians that are moving into the house. You don't know what they're gonna do. And we all laughed, because we're like, what are we gonna do? We're gonna lesbian you to death?
Yeah.
I guess so. I mean, I didn't get my toaster oven last year for the people that I, you know, turned, but now I'm really looking forward to it. So it was just so funny, because it brought conversations that I think we weren't expecting to have right away moving in, but we've gained more allies doing that.
Right.
And we've gained more spokespeople for our son that have his back, that are right there defending him. So that's been really nice.
And isn't it interesting that you had those, oh, be careful of those gays.
That's right.
Because that's what black and brown people have been forever.
Yes.
Right. Right, exactly.
Right.
So be careful of the neighborhood. It's going down.
It's going down now. That's exactly what, that was the sentiment. It's changing.
It's changing.
Well,
change is good.
Change is good,
right?
Yes.
Appreciate and own and be outspoken about where you live. So we're here. You know, I started a mom's group. And I have over 3,000 moms in my mom's group, and they know about us. And Stacy and I and my twins were our twins. We're just on the cover of the local magazine, and we are here, and we're not hiding, and we show up and we say who we are, and we're vocal. You know, when it's the July 4th celebration, it's like, excuse me, please don't put those flags in my yard. We celebrate June 19th here. You know, that was when we were free. And so we're outspoken, we're loud, we're proud, and we're showing up. And I think that's just the most important thing. And that's what I encourage so many people to do, because if they can see it, they can believe it. And so we have to be part of that change. And so I encourage so many people to make sure that they speak up, speak
That's
out,
mm-hmm.
and be part of that change.
I'm just overwhelmed by the discussion and by what I heard from everyone. And some themes that I know that I heard was the resilience within our community. But I also love that I heard the joy as well. Lots of joy within these stories. And I think one thing is clear is that it's going to take some time to fix all of these issues that we've discussed today. And it is definitely a challenge to navigate the school system, whether you're a queer parent, whether you're a parent with a child of color. It's a difficult road now. And what I'm proud about is the work that Family Equality is doing. Because I think one thing is clear, that we have to protect our kids. And the reason that we do have to protect our kids, because they are the advocates of the future. And someday they will be advocating for us. And someday they will be sitting on this couch and talking about the same things, maybe different things. Let's hope for the future that they'll be talking about different things. But one thing is for sure, that they are the advocates of the future, and we need to protect them at all costs. So thank you everyone for joining, and thank you for all my guests, Sherilyn Stevenson, Melanie Main, Jackie Juarez, Sonia Parker Good, and our awesome facilitator, Luna Malbro.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. Awesome. Am I talk show host yet?
Yay! All right. Hug it out.
Thanks for listening. Now, we've been doing topics for family conversation at the end of episodes, But these panelists just really sparked so many ideas themselves. So I'll just leave us with one topic to kind of take with us and maybe have in the car or on the dinner table as a family today. It is, when you experience or notice discrimination in school based on race or being in an LGBTQ plus family or gender or another identity, who can you talk to? What can you do? And what support do you need from trusted adults? Well, all, thank you again for listening to this incredible conversation. You can connect with Family Equality at familyequality.org and find us on social media at Family Equality on Facebook and Instagram, and at Family_Equality on Twitter.